We arrive here today to debate at social distances from each other.
There's no doubt that the old politics of the two-party system is now gone and over.
I don't need lectures from you or anybody on the Sinn Féin side of the house.
We're very reluctant to say what's red lines, but we do have to take climate seriously.
There's going to be constant criticism, there's going to be a lot of disappointment, and whoever goes into government is going to be unpopular.
Okay. Hello, and you're very welcome to RTE News' Your Politics podcast. I'm Paul Cunningham. Our political brain box this week is Sandra Hurley, and we also have a political guest who is Sinn Féin's Owen O'Brien. Owen, how goes?
Not too bad, Paul. Thanks very much.
We're going to talk about housing policy and probably a couple of other issues before that. But first things first, are you sick to death talking about housing? Do you not look at your colleague from Wicklow, John Brady, who's the foreign affairs spokesperson? He's talking about the United Nations. He's talking about Tigray, Syria. He's talking about the great problems of the world. And you're still talking about bricks and mortar.
No, in fact, and as you well know, Paul, I've been a housing activist in one form or another for almost 20 years. So it's not just a job for me, it's a passion, but also like a lot of constituency politicians, housing is the number one issue in my constituency, whether you're languishing on a social housing waiting list, in emergency accommodation, paying very high rent or looking to buy. And therefore, it's an issue that the people who elected me to this house want me to raise. And therefore, I'm very happy to raise it. And I'm passionate about trying to get these issues addressed.
So you're still in for it?
Yeah, and keep in mind, I'm not just a spokesperson on housing. I do a lot of work on planning, on water, on local government. And obviously, heritage, both built and natural heritage, has recently been transferred to the line department, which I follow. So I have a steep learning curve in terms of the natural heritage work. But I've had a long interest in built heritage and particularly architecture. So they're all new pieces of work that I have to fit into my working day, as well as trying to come up with better ways to address housing need.
Okay, before we get into your brief, because clearly that was the topic of the week, a couple of other issues. We had Neil Richmond in the podcast studio just a couple of weeks ago, and he was reminding us that the full name and the official name of Fine Gael is Fine Gael, the United Ireland Party. And we've also had Fianna Fáil, Jim O'Callaghan. He's been out in Cambridge University talking about United Ireland. Sinn Féin, are you having your clothes stolen from you?
No, and first of all, I really welcome the interventions both of Neil and Jim. We have always said that advancing the cause of Irish unity has to be a broad-based campaign. It needs as wide a range of political opinion as possible. And whether you're somebody on the Christian Democratic right, as Neil Richmond is, somebody in the kind of liberal centre, as Jim O'Callaghan is, or a left Republican like me, we all have a role to play in that dialogue, as do, of course, people from a range of communities and political traditions, both north and south. So no, we want this conversation to be broad. We want it to be deep. We want it to be evidence-based. And I have to say, while we might not agree on some of the details on the pathway to United Ireland, or indeed what that Ireland might look like afterwards, the fact that we're all now having this conversation is really welcome.
One of the things that Sinn Féin wants is a border poll possibly within 5 years. Is that not akin to basically Brexit, which is we'll get the deal done and then we'll figure out all the hard stuff after it's actually happened?
No, and the reason why we've said we want it within that kind of time frame is because that gives us time to prepare. When myself and Pierce and Louise and David Cullinan were involved in the programme for government negotiations over a year ago, we were arguing very strongly that the incoming government should place preparation for that unity referendum at the centre of the Department of Taoiseach. That means that a lot of the empirical research, a lot of the data, a lot of the economic analysis, and also kind of information around what would an All-Ireland health system look like, housing system look like, etc., all of that could be done. It would be an enormous mistake for us to have the kind of ill-informed, politically ill-judged and acrimonious referendum campaign that the Conservative Party and right-wingers like UKIP forced on Britain and particularly on England. We want to have a reasoned, evidence-based debate, something a little bit more like what happened in Scotland in their independence referendum, albeit one that was lost there. Nobody will benefit, particularly those of us advocating Irish reunification, from an acrimonious, ill-informed debate. And that's why we want preparation. That's why we want information and evidence. And that's why we want to hear all sides. And we don't want to be prescriptive about what the other end of that looks like. And I think, in fact, what's really welcome in recent times is between, for example, the RTE primetime programme, the recent opinion polling by the Irish Independent, Lucid Talks opinion polling in the North. There is a conversation now happening everywhere about what a united Ireland would look like. Do we want it? How we would get there? And I have to say, nobody should be scared of dialogue. Nobody should be scared of debate. And as we've seen with our own recent referenda here in this state, issues which were historically very, very divisive, such as, for example, reproductive rights, we can have referenda which are respectful, which are thoughtful, and which on the other side of it, people respect the outcome, irrespective of if it's the outcome they wanted.
Okay, I mean, Sinn Féin is an all-Ireland party. You were very strong in Northern Ireland, but you've also had a bit of a blip this week. We heard that Martina Anderson and a colleague are not going to stand again as MLAs in Derry. And I'm wondering if you can explain why that is the case, because she is a Republican icon. She is, you know, certainly well regarded within the Sinn Féin movement. And someone's come down to her and said, listen, take the old hi-ho, you're gone.
So look, first of all, I wasn't involved in the party's review of the Derry party organisation, and I'm not on the Ard Cóirle at the moment, so I don't know the detail of the review. But I can make a couple of general observations, and I say all of this, of course, as somebody who's worked very closely with Martina over many, many years and considers her a friend as well as a party colleague. Look, in any big organisation where you're trying to grow your party, increase your political strength and deliver real change, there are times when in certain constituencies, the party organisation needs renewal. And obviously, in this case, the party set up a panel. The panel went in and did a review and made a series of recommendations. They would have been approved then by the party's Ard Cóirle, the governing body. Some of those recommendations included asking the sitting officer board that manages the party in the city to stand down and asking the two MLAs in the constituency not to put their names forward again. They were requests, and obviously the MLAs had to think very hard about it. I think the fact that particularly Martina, a Republican of such long standing, was willing to take on board the recommendations of the review panel and withdraw her name from contesting the selection bench in the next time round, I think that's a testament of her commitment to the party, to the Republican struggle and to the people of Derry. That would have been a really tough decision. I don't doubt that at all. But I suppose...
But why did things go so badly? I mean, Colm Eastwood came in and took, not just took the seat, but he took it by 17,000 votes. And a few months before that, in the Derry and Strabane councils, he lost four or five seats as well. So we're talking about an implosion in an area most people would have felt that Sinn Féin was going to do well.
Yeah, and I suppose that's part of the reason why the party did the review, and in a constituency I know much better, in North Belfast, where I was an elected councillor, the party had the opposite result, had its best election result ever, and increased its vote and seat share. Look, it's not that I don't want to comment on the detail, Paul. I'm just not across it. I'm very busy as a constituency politician and as a front bench spokesperson here. But what I will say is this. For Sinn Féin, politics is not about personal advancement. It's not about careerism. It's about advancing the political objectives of the party for Irish reunification and a democratic socialist republic. And none of us, and that includes me, put ourselves above what we see as the broader interest of the party and the constituencies we represent. So all I would say is, whereas other political parties, it tends to be about the individual, not the collective. For us, it's about the collective and the political project. And I have even more admiration for Martina now than I would have had before. And that was quite a heavy amount of admiration, because I think she's done the right thing by the party and the Republican constituency of Derry.
Okay.
She will also remain an active Sinn Féin member and continue to contribute to the Republican struggle in the time ahead. And I think that's great news for the party.
Can I ask you about that phrase, just the Republican struggle? Because there's a certain nuance to it where people are as old as me would recognise it as meaning one thing, but maybe people don't recognise it today. I mean, Martina Anderson, when she was an MLA, had taken over from Robert McCartney, who had been a member of the Provisional IRA, who had been a hunger striker. And we had another controversy earlier on this month when we had Matt Carty talking about Seamus McElwain, saying that another former Provisional IRA member who had been killed was still held in huge esteem, very fondly remembered by all who knew him. And, you know, this is the person who was blamed by the First Minister, Arlene Foster, for a near fatal gun attack on her father.
Yeah, and it's one of the great challenges we have coming out of conflict, that within all communities, there are people who are held in high esteem, people who are combatants in that conflict. and people who inflicted hurt on others. And at the same time, the communities from where those individuals come have a very different view. They believe those people were patriots. They believe those people were defenders of their community, and they want to be able to remember those people. I think what we have to be able to do as a society to move forward is find ways to remember our dead, to celebrate their lives and remember them and pay respect to their families and communities without inflicting greater hurt on others. That's a very tricky thing to do, and it applies to all communities and to all of the different groups of combatants, whether they were state or non-state actors. And look, we don't always get it right, nor do other sides. But it is legitimate for Republicans to want to remember Mairead Farrell or Bobby Sands, just as it is legitimate for Republicans to want to remember, for example, Thomas McCurtain or Michael Collins or others.
Yeah.
But we have to try and find ways of doing that that are respectful, that are thoughtful. And at the same time, for those, for example, on the other side of the conflict that affected our island over 30 years, for those people to be able to remember their dead, but also in a way that doesn't inflict hurt and greater pain on the people who are the victims of their violence. And look, I think if we're thoughtful about that, we can work our way through it.
Two other questions before we talk about housing. One is the ABU system, which continues to cause controversy. Is this not a case, and to borrow a phrase from Michael Noonan, that you just need to get the dead cat off the road? I heard Leo Varadkar saying that he was prepared to sit down with Mary Lou McDonald and help her get rid of the system so that we could all move on together.
Yeah, so when your political opponents start offering you help, you should always get very suspicious. So I don't think Leo Varadkar's offer was in any way genuine. It's a deeply cynical move by the Taoiseach. Look, first of all, we have a data protection commissioner. That office is the statutory organisation to ensure compliance with data protection law. We're engaging directly and comprehensively with the DPC. Every single question that we've been asked, we're answering. Every shred of information the Data Protection Commissioner is asking for, we are providing. And then the Data Protection Commissioner will provide her view on the other side of this. We believe, notwithstanding that there were a number of omissions around a data protection officer and a data protection impact assessment, which the DPC has brought to our attention and we've addressed, we believe the core of the system is compliant with data protection law. We believe it is a good system, a more professionalised way of doing what we've always done in other forums and what other parties do. And therefore, I think the best course of action is for the DPC to be allowed to do her work, for her to make her views known. And if there are any issues or concerns that she raises, we will address those fully and comprehensively. But the core issue is this. The Data Protection Act of 2018 allows political parties to collect information on voting intentions, particularly where people are indicating they're going to vote for your candidate or your party. Political parties of all shades gather that information, whether they store it in pen and paper, in a filing cabinet, on an individual database in their constituency, or on the kind of system that we have. There is nothing wrong or sinister in that. The Taoiseach knows that. And therefore, I think he should let the DPC do her job. And then we can deal with the outcome of that when her outcome is known.
Okay, one last one. Just in relation to Dublin Bay South, when there was a by-election in Dublin Midwest, in your constituency, you went to the local councillor, Mark Ward, who successfully came through. Do you think in Dublin Bay South that the local councillor, Dr. I think it's Daniel Ketlin, should be the person who should come through into the constituency rather than someone from outside, maybe from the Shannon or anything like that?
So we have very clear procedures for selecting candidates. The party's election department works with the local constituency organisation to help them do some electoral analysis, to run the numbers, to see if the seat is winnable and what kind of electoral strategy we'd want to have. Then they start looking at candidates, and then there's a selection convention, and whoever wants to put their name forward puts the name forward, and the members decide. I'm not, again, just to say, I'm not directly involved in any of that work, and therefore I'm not so sure what stage it's at. What I hope the party will do is select the very best candidate to win the seat, and whoever they select, and I won't be involved in that selection process, I will give them every ounce that I have of my energy during the course of that by-election to knock as many doors and to convince people that we really need a change, particularly in the area of housing, which I'm responsible for. But beyond that, it's up to the party, both locally and centrally, to deal with the mechanics of the selection process.
Okay, well, let's move on to housing. Sandra Hurley, as I said, is joining us. How would you characterise this week as one both from the government's point of view and how the opposition have used the travails that they found themselves in?
Yeah, I think it's been a reminder that the big issue once the pandemic lifts is going to be housing again, as it was last year in the general election. And there's been a complete reminder that the government is very vulnerable here. And I think there is an awareness across all the government parties that it faces really potential lasting damage here that it can't seem to dig itself out of. You had the housing minister bring forward his affordable housing bill to cabinet on Tuesday. There are some elements of that that have been welcomed by the opposition, but a lot of focus on the shared equity scheme, which many have said will push up housing prices. And then you've had that running story about investment funds buying up large proportions of already built houses in Maynooth and in Dublin 15. And the government, I think, today is a little bit at odds trying to come up with solutions to that. There's suggestions about amending and tackling this through the planning regulations. There's also suggestions about tackling it through maybe reducing the amount of tax incentives that are there for funds to come in this way, or perhaps some sort of other legislative change. But I don't think there's quite agreement yet across government on how to do this. There's agreement that it needs to be tackled. We've had that from Eamon Ryan, from the Taoiseach and from the Taoiseach, but I don't think they've quite been able to agree on how to do it. And what is also clear is that they are not going to be able to curb this quickly as much as they would like to. It's clearly going to take a little bit of time.
Sinn Féin, as the housing spokesperson for Sinn Féin, what would be your view just on that particular problem? Would you favour an outright ban, as seems to be in place in places like Germany, or would you support what the government's trying to do, which is basically clip the wings of international investors?
Of course, the first thing is I don't know what the government's going to do, because I just read an article online in one of the broadsheets and there were four government ministers all quoted, all saying different things. I think two policies need to be introduced as a matter of urgency. The first is that the tax treatment of these investment funds needs to change. They should pay tax on the rent roll. They should pay a stamp duty at a higher rate than they currently do. And they should pay capital gains tax. I mean, one of the things that isn't getting talked about enough today is we have a large number of single property landlords who pay an effective rate of tax on their rental income of about 40%. And if they sell the property, they pay capital gains tax. Yet these institutional landlords pay none of that. And some don't even pay dividend withholding tax in the state if they're overseas investors. So that's something we've been calling for years. Piers Doherty led the charge on that, but myself and others have been calling for it. And government, both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, have continually not only opposed it, but voted against it when we've tabled amendments in the finance bill to do such that. On the other side, on the planning side, I think two things need to happen. The first is we do need to look at some emergency changes to planning law to try and limit the sale of housing estates, not just in the suburbs, but also in the city centre, that were built for the purposes of selling to owner-occupiers being subsequently purchased by investment funds. And I think that is possible, but it can't be done quickly because it's quite a complicated constitutional and legal matter. And unfortunately, this government, despite the fact that they've known about the problem for some years, hasn't done any of the preparation.
Can I ask
beyond,
you just...
But beyond that, I do think there's another change that we need. When you put in a planning application, you have to stipulate the number of houses, the style of houses and the size of those houses. Why don't we change planning law into the future to require developers to stipulate whether they want this to be a rental development, an owner-occupied development or a mixture, and then let the planning authorities actually make informed decisions about what's the right type of development or mix into the future. That won't capture the developments that are currently being built. We need some emergency provisions for that. But I think it's time to introduce a 10-year requirement into all future planning applications, both because it would be a good way to do planning and it would ensure we never return to this problem in the future.
We're just trying to tease out the role that international investors could have under your plans. I mean, when it came to the collapse of the economy and NAMA and all of that land being available and nothing was happening, the government says international investors came in when we didn't have a bob and were able to generate house completions, finish off estates, like they actually served a purpose. So in today's world, when you say you can deal with it from a tax point of view, is that with a view to limiting their role, or are you trying to eclipse or ban them?
Well, two things. First of all, the very, very generous tax incentives that were introduced by Michael Noonan and his Minister for Finance, John Moran, were precisely to deal, I suppose, with the toxic debt that had been taken over by NAMA and to attract international investment capital to come in and buy those debts and develop out those in the main commercial, although in small numbers, residential developments. The problem we've had for the last 3, 4, maybe 5 years is as the kind of toxic commercial and land debts associated with NAMA have been bought up, many controversially, that investment capital is still looking for a home and it's moved into residential development. So that's a reality that we've known about and government has sat on its hands to do nothing for quite some time. We also need to distinguish between different types of investors. So first of all, there are investors who want to invest in good quality residential developments to sell or to rent. And they partner with building contractors, they put in planning applications, they build out their developments and they sell them or they rent them. And there's nothing wrong with that so long as the quality of the accommodation is good and the price is reasonable and there's no problem with any of that.
What type of investors are you talking about? I mean, Leo Varadkar was mentioning the Dáil today that his ears pricked up when he mentioned you were talking about pension funds coming in for long-term involvement in the property market and this was the first time he'd heard you say that.
Well, I've been saying it for quite some time and I talked about it in my book, which was published 2 years ago on the housing crisis. The key issue, however, is the type of investment, right? So if there are investors, whether they're pension funds or other kinds of investors who want to come into the Irish market or who are in the Irish market, if they want to buy land, employ contractors, secure planning permission, and build developments to rent or sell, so long as it's good quality and it's affordable, I have no difficulty with that. What we have at the moment, however, is something very different, which is in the main, we have short-term, high-yield investors, and that's why we call them vulture funds. They come in and they have access to very, very large volumes of very, very low-cost finance, and they're able to outbid everybody else, and they're pushing up the price of land, they're pushing up the overall development cost, and then they're pushing up the actual cost of the sale price of the unit, whether for an owner-occupier or for a subsequent investor to buy. And that's distorting our market. And actually, it's putting some of the longer term, low yield investors who operate in a number of other jurisdictions from even coming into the Irish market. And therefore, in a sense, we need to close off the negative types of investment, short term, high yield. We need to very significantly increase the volume of public investment, whether that's funded through government borrowing at low rates, the European Investment Bank, the Housing Finance Agency, etc. So we have far greater public sector, non-for-profit delivery of affordable homes to rent or buy, not the paltry few hundred a year that Dara O'Brien is talking about, but thousands and thousands annually as they do in other jurisdictions. And that will deal with a lot of not just the social, but the affordable purchase and rental supply. And then on the private side, because there will always be a private sector and there will always be private housing and there's no problem with that. What we need is we need to get back to a model which really existed in Ireland before the liberalisation of mortgage finance in the 80s and 90s. Where you had very reputable builders and you had very reputable providers of finance who built large volumes of good quality private homes that working people could buy. You know, the family home that my mother and father yeah. bought when they were bank clerks back in the 70s in Cabinteely. The difficulty is we don't have that. And therefore, let's get rid of the very distorting tax regime that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have actively supported for over a decade. And let's get back to, first of all, greater public investment in social affordable homes, but also good quality, long-term, low-yield private sector development, less speculative development. And that will provide good quality homes for working people to okay. rent or buy, depending on what meets their needs.
The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, Sandra Hurley, was speaking in the Dáil about the government's approach to housing. And he was saying, to a certain extent, some of the things that Eoghan Brin has just been saying just now as well, in the view of that they wanted people to own their homes, they felt that when it came to international investors, that it had gone too far and they were going to try and do something about it.
Yes, I think Leo Varadkar was very much putting forward that message today. He was really on the back foot, though, because, you know, the Social Democrats, Sinn Féin and People Before Profit were all on the attack over housing policy. And I think he was also pushing back on that suggestion that Fine Gael has been overly kind in terms of the tax incentives given to these type of funds. He's pointing out that, you know, they do pay taxes on their dividends, that type of thing. I think something else that I noticed today that's interesting is that Pascal Donoghue was questioned about this by Piers Doherty at the Finance Committee, and I just caught the end of it, and the Minister was very careful, cautious, I suppose, about what he was saying, because he would always be careful about giving out a signal as to what he might do with the tax code, but he is examining it. But he put it very carefully, and it got to the nub of it. He said that he would be examining whether the existing tax structure gave an advantage to these type of investment funds when it came to buying up entirely already built housing developments. And I think that is reinforcing the view put forward by the Taoiseach and others, that they still want these investment funds in the market. They believe that they're important in terms of providing finance to get apartments and housing built from the get-go, but they don't want them coming in and buying up entirely built projects. Now, they're insisting that this is at a very small level at the moment, but they don't want it getting a bigger foothold.
Owen O'Brien, where do you stand on this issue? When we've been talking about this issue over the past 2 days, it's focused an awful lot on houses. I haven't necessarily heard people, as Sandra just said there, houses and apartments.
Yeah, that's a very worrying concern. So the idea that's being floated now, and I think Dara O'Brien is quoted in one of the online broadsheets today, suggesting that one of the options they're looking at is restricting the bulk buying of already built estates in the suburbs, but not in the city centre, as if somehow the types of people who live or want to live in the city centre don't want to own their own homes. That would be a very retrograde step. You see, government should not tell people whether they should rent or buy. Government should be tenure neutral, and they should ensure that there's a sufficient supply of affordable homes to rent or buy, to let people to make up their own minds. But we need people to be able to buy homes as well as rent in the city centre, in apartments, in duplexes, in bungalows, as well as in the suburbs. And given the fact that government policy actually wants to see a kind of an end to suburban sprawl, a policy that I fully support, and greater emphasis on the delivery of larger volumes of higher density homes within our urban centres, again, an eminently sensible proposal, they can't do that unless they allow those people who want to buy to be able to buy, as well as those people who want to be able to rent affordably. So the idea that somehow this is only a problem in the suburbs, I think ignores, in fact, the bulk of these block purchases. And these are block purchases after the fact, are actually in our city centres. And that's why it's so expensive to rent and impossible to buy in the city centre. And that's contrary to what the government is trying to do, both in terms of combat growth and combating climate change.
Oh, I did want to just have a conversation about talking about cities and towns. It was interesting to see the independent TD for Limerick, Richard O'Donoghue, was talking about the difficulties that are taking place in rural Ireland, where there's a limit, he said, on one-off housing. He felt that infrastructure wasn't in place like storage for smaller towns, which meant that people didn't have the ability to grow areas. Instead, they got funneled into cities, prolonging the problem. What's your sense about what could be done, or what's Sinn Féin's position, what can be done for rural communities as opposed to, you know, the big conurbations?
Well, firstly, we need to be evidence-based. So if you look at where population decline has been the greatest between the last two census, it's actually in our urban centres. It's Dublin City Centre, it's Cork City Centre, but also some of our regional towns as well. And therefore, the first thing is there are very large numbers of people who want to live in those cities and towns, and we have to make housing affordable there. The second thing is in fact, a quarter of all house completions last year were one-off and predominantly rural. So there is a very large volume of one-off rural homes being developed, and that doesn't necessarily mean they're being developed in the area that Richard represents and he's advocating for. So what we need to do in rural Ireland, I think, is a number of things. First of all, we have to revive our rural villages and towns, and that means a greater focus on vacant properties and affordability there. And then in the countryside, so outside of the villages and towns, we need to ensure that where there are new residential developments, they are sustainable. That means that it's not necessarily unregulated ribbon development, but we have small clusters and hamlets that have access to proper services such as water, roads and public transport, but also then can sustain some level of basic services like post offices, etc. I think that can be done, but I think government needs to work with rural communities to ensure, just as they're providing, for example, infrastructure funding through the Service Sites Fund to deliver affordable homes in the cities, they also need to do something similar for the countryside to ensure both in the villages and towns and in the rural areas, we can meet people's housing needs, but in a way that is sustainable, reduces car dependency where possible, and allows us to tackle not only the housing crisis, but also the climate crisis as well.
Owen O'Brien, Sinn Féin's housing spokesperson, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast. Sandra, this housing issue, it certainly suddenly seems to have bubbled out of anywhere. If you're looking at the front page of the newspaper, it's been virus, virus, virus. Looking at the television, first story is virus. And then suddenly this week, housing policy. It wasn't that the issue went away, but by God, it's roared back into life.
Yeah, it really has. It's kind of astonishing, really, how much it's been obscured by the pandemic. I mean, that's not a surprise. But I think the point has been made, and it is understood across government, that this is just still the number one issue, and they are in such trouble in it. It's also very clear that in the upcoming by-election in Dublin Bay South, Sinn Féin have made it very clear they're going to make it all about housing. They've said that publicly, repeatedly. So it's just going to gear up even more. And I think the fact that then that it kicked off this week with that story about the housing development in Maynooth, that has just propelled it. And it really is the number one issue at the moment.
I suppose one of the things we keep hearing about, it's all about supply. Mm-hmm. And yet they're not able to get the supply because in part the pandemic has closed down all the construction. So they're on the back foot, like from the off.
Yeah, completely. And I heard the Fianna Fáil TD James O'Connor today talking about that. And he was talking about, you know, the difficulties caused by COVID. And he said, we're not going to be able to fix this in months. And he was pointing to 2022. Now, I think that's very difficult for government. I mean, there's a lot of things that the government would be hoping, both in terms of COVID and housing, that the government can last long enough that they'll see sort of an upswing in the second half of the government, and that would propel them forwards to a better election result in the future. But it's still a long time to wait. And yes, it's understandable that COVID has hugely disrupted construction, but at the same time, that's not a real help to people who are stuck and who are looking to buy or looking to get a foothold in the rental market. And it seems that the government is tackling this in many different ways, but it's just not having a quick enough effect.
I mean, it does bring us back to that decision by the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, in which he chose some of the big, you know, portfolios. Mm-hmm. He chose health and all that went in with it, because he knew we were in the pandemic by then. And he chose housing, which had been the sort of lightning rod issue for the election.
Yeah, and it's kind of brave moves, really. If you want to fix it, get in there and take those difficult ministries, put your people in there. He put the two people in there who had been the spokespeople in opposition, put them into the hot seat and let's see what they can do. But I think something that's also been very interesting over the past 24 hours is that at last night's parliamentary party meetings, you know, it was pretty clear that Fianna Fáil was pointing the finger at Fine Gael. Fine Gael was pointing the finger at Fianna Fáil. And the two parties are really disagreeing on this now. They're blaming each other. And that also has been something that the opposition has pounced on. You know, Roisin Shortall talking about this in the Dáil today, that calling it a circular firing squad, and basically, in her view, saying that they're both to blame. Piers Doherty saying the same thing. And they both have difficulties with it in terms of a legacy issue. Fine Gael has been in power since 2011. They brought in these particular real estate investment trusts under Michael Noonan in 2013 that are very controversial just this week. And Fianna Fáil, in the words of Roisin Shortall, you know, crashed the housing market and are still dealing with the aftermath of that 10 years on. And as Sinn Féin put it, in the last government, Fianna Fáil facilitated the decisions taken by Fine Gael, and this is a problem for both of them. And that was really manifest, I think, apparently a very strong contribution from John Lahart, the Fianna Fáil TD, at their meeting, saying that they were sort of living in the shadows of the Fine Gael housing policy, and that it was a huge problem.
But I mean, I guess the thing is, the coalition has to hang together. If it doesn't hang together, it falls apart, and they're not going to get any rewards because they haven't advanced things. And yet, despite that fact, we've still got the theatrics of the housing minister, who happens to be from Fianna Fáil, heading into the Fine Gael parliamentary party meeting at some stage this month.
Yes, although I suppose it won't be in person, will it? So that might hold back the fireworks a little bit, but it's pretty unusual. I think there's been one or two cases before of ministers addressing the other party's meetings, but it's very rare. So it's slated for maybe 2 weeks' time, and it's kind of a brave move by Dara O'Brien to go in directly and answer his critics and see what they throw back at him. But I also thought today, he was sort of, in some of his media interviews, he's been talking a lot about a whole of government approach and very much pointing to the tax side. That happens to be Pascal Donoghue's area. So I think there's a bit of finger pointing going on at ministerial level also. But of course, as you point out, the government needs to hang together on this. They're stronger together than if they start pointing the finger at each other.
I suppose the other thing is that it's very difficult to pin all of your hopes or fears on one individual, on one minister, because, you know, they are just a single person. It is the government policy, and they have to come up with that policy, drive through that policy, and make sure that that policy delivers.
Yeah, and we're always told about, you know, cabinet collective responsibility. They all sign off on things. And even though we get these leaks that Minister A or B or whatever maybe, you know, objected to something and raised very strong objections, at the same time, constitutionally, they all sign off on it. They all hold responsibility and they all have to shoulder the blame. And they all also all have to go out and publicly you know, fight for those policies and back them up in terms of media interviews and maybe in panels, maybe with something that they don't personally like, but it's important for them. And it's also important for the coalition to hang together, that Fianna Fáil supports Fine Gael policies and they support green policies and all that. And they all get their individual wins. That's significant as well.
It would be remiss of us not to talk about vaccines, as we have done for nearly every podcast of late. Where are we on that? I mean, there seemed to be some focus on this 27th review of the vaccine rollout programme. But as the days have gone on, it seems as if that review isn't going to amount to very much, because there isn't actually going to be any change anyway.
Yeah, that may be the case. Now, we're not going to hear about it until next week, but it reminds me a little bit of, you know, it was suggested that that there would be major changes perhaps that they were looking at in terms of spacing out the time between taking your first dose and your second dose of Pfizer, and that never came to anything in the end either. I think there's a feeling in government that they are getting somewhere now, that they're heading towards their targets. Maybe they won't quite meet all the targets that have been set out, but Paul Reid from the HSE was saying today, you know, they're about to hit 33% of people with their first dose. So one in three adults has a dose of the vaccine. Everyone's been who has got it has been very happy to get it. And there's a sense in government that it's sort of coming good at this stage. There's going to be a lot of focus still on supply and maybe reaching that end of June target. But I think that even if that target slips a little bit at the end of June, as long as they get pretty close to it, there's a feeling that things will be okay.
And then we've got the big bonus day coming up on Monday, the 10th, isn't it? Where things are going to happen and people are going to get a real sense that maybe we're getting out of this.
Yes, inter-county travel back on, the hairdressers back open, you can have retail by appointment, click and collect, all these kind of things. So that's going to make a big difference in a real way to people's lives, in terms of, especially, of course, people back at work, people who've been out since Christmas. If you're a hairdresser or a retail worker, you're going to get back, and small businesses are going to get back reopened. So that hopefully should help things, and it should also ease the pressure on the public finances. You should see a big drop in the numbers on the PUP. Of course, then the other battleground looms, as we know, in terms of how to cut the PUP or taper it off, and the wage subsidy scheme. And there's a meeting on that today, the Economic Recovery Subcommittee of Cabinet, and government realises that this is just going to be such a headache in terms of trying to roll this back.
Yeah, it seems as if they probably kicked that into September on the basis that you can't really taper or slash the PUP in July, when many people are working in hospitality and their jobs won't be back yet.
Yes, that's the signal that has been given. You know, no cliff edge, and certainly it has moved from
cliff
July.
Edge.
Yes, sorry. Is that one of those buzzwords that we're not supposed to say? And the signal has been given that it would be more towards September. But the government has promised to set out a plan on all of this to make it clear to businesses and individuals, and to have that together by the end of May. So that is looming quite soon.
Is there anything else on the agenda over the coming days, or do you think that just housing is just going to continue to roll? There's too many angles on the story for it to peter out.
Housing is just back in a big way, really, and I expect there will be more stories on this. And then bubbling in the background, you've got the by-election. We've had a few confirmations of candidates over the past week, James Gagan, Hazel Chew. No surprises there. Still don't know about Kate O'Connell. I'm told Fine Gael party headquarters haven't had any contact either, so they're waiting to see. The deadline is Monday, so she has to declare by then. Perhaps it could unveil something over the weekend. There's been some speculation on that.
A Sunday splash.
If you were her PR advisor, you'd advise her to do a Sunday splash and hold it for one of the Sunday newspapers, perhaps. But she hasn't revealed anything yet. I think at this stage, if she wasn't running, would she have told us? Perhaps she would have. So that maybe leads people to think that she is considering it very seriously.
We've mentioned Fine Gael. We've mentioned Sinn Féin with Eoin O'Brien. We've mentioned the Green Party. We'll just might as well go through. What other candidates do we know, say, from Fianna Fáil?
Fianna Fáil is choosing between two sitting councillors, Deirdre Conroy and Claire O'Connell. It was confirmed today that Jim O'Callaghan, the TD, as expected, will be the Director of Elections. Pressure on him to get a decent result. People Before Profit have confirmed Bridget Purcell as their candidate.
That was today.
Yes, Aintu says it's running a candidate.
25, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 25
results. Oh, she's 25. Okay, very good. Yes, and a woman as well. It looks like a female-dominated ticket. And Sinn Féin is the one we're all waiting for. So yeah. Names mentioned there, Lynn Boylan, Fintan Warfield and Daniel Caton. But,
and then Labour, we do know what they're doing.
Oh, Ivana Bacic, that's right. Yes.
And we still don't know about the former Minister for Justice.
Yes, possibly enjoying a little bit of the spotlight, could we say, and hasn't ruled himself out yet.
Okay, Sandra Hurley, thank you very much for bringing us all of that news. And thanks very much for listening to Your Politics podcast. Please do subscribe. Please do leave a comment. We love to hear from you. And we'll catch you again next week.